is the Eco Modernist Podcast. Our philosophy is based on sound science and free from the outdated dogmas of the 20th century.
Hi, this is Gabe Ignetti.
And this is John Entine.
And this is the Eco Modernist Podcast. We live in a wondrous age of scientific discovery that has led to both good and bad results for both human health and the environment. There are times when either corporate greed or simply unintended consequences cause havoc. Scientific progress must always entail a degree of risk. And so the subject of our show today is just how much risk is or should be tolerated, and how well equipped is our legal system to protect workers and consumers in this regard. There is probably no better person to answer these prickly questions from a scientific perspective than Dr. Jeffrey Kabat.
Jeffrey Kabat is a cancer epidemiologist who has been on the faculty of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and the Stony Brook University School of Medicine. He is the author of Hyping Health Risks, Environmental Hazards in Daily Life, and The Science of Epidemiology and Getting Risk Right, Understanding the Science of Elusive Health Risks. In addition, he has written many peer-reviewed papers as well as numerous articles for Forbes, Slate, and other websites.
Speaking about this problem from a legal perspective is Drew Kirshen, Earl Sneed Centennial Professor of Law Emeritus at the University of Oklahoma College of Law. Professor Kirshen taught agricultural law courses for over 30 years, with a particular emphasis on agricultural biotechnology from 1997 until his retirement in 2012. Issues, including risk analysis related to agricultural biotechnology. And it would be remiss if I didn't mention our co-host, John Entine, who is founder and director of the Genetic Literacy Project, and an author and an award-winning journalist. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
There's a great deal of public suspicion of science, along with a profound distrust of the chemical products and medicines that come out of our laboratories. Where does that distrust emerge from? In what cases is it well-founded, and how are we as laymen to tell the difference between unfounded scares and concerns that are supported by science?
I think part of the problem is that we've been programmed by hundreds of thousands of years of evolution to pay attention to threats in our environment. For instance, we had to be on the alert to not be eaten by a lion. But the responses that were appropriate are not well suited to the modern world. And another aspect of modern civilization is that we're all constantly being bombarded by information about factors that may be affecting our health. And what makes for a good headline in the media may turn out to be based on very flimsy science, and often is. But as we know, fear really sells. And these scares tap into our hardwired survival instinct. And need only to look at what's been happening recently with vaccination for measles to see how these scares and false narratives can dominate the discussion and have a serious influence on behavior.
From my legal perspective, it seems to me that as a society, we seem to have lost our confidence in science. And to my mind, I think there are two trends that have influenced this loss in confidence. The first trend is a general trend against all authority, and science is seen as an authority. And in contrast to that antagonism to authority, we've moved in favor of personal autonomy, our own feelings and our own emotions as the validating source of our judgments. And the second trend seems to be at romanticism, meaning a belief that nature is always good, are considered better ways of dealing with risk and the physical world than the rational scientific method. There's a very good book that discusses this tension between these trends that I've just talked about that I just want to mention. It's a book by Charles C. Mann called The Wizard and the Prophet, Two Remarkable Scientists and Their Dueling Visions to Shape Tomorrow's World.
Well, both of you have raised some fascinating questions about risk and how we interpret them. So let's drill down to really one of the fundamental questions here, which is the issue of toxicity. There's an old and famous dictum that correlation does not equal causality. People have suggested that the consumption of GMOs or the use of glyphosate, an herbicide that is often paired with it, has led to a dramatic increase in autism. And others have pointed out that the correlation is identical to the consumption of organic food in autism. Perhaps you guys can address that.
Observational studies attempt to correlate a statistical association. And these studies are very useful, that what they provide are associations. And the mere fact of two variables being associated does not ensure that one causes the other. For example, they could both have a common cause, or the association could be due to a third factor, which is the true cause, or the association could simply be due to chance. So a study raises an initial question, and you need more careful studies, larger studies, more powerful studies, and studies of different types to see whether you really understand the phenomenon you're looking at. So you can see that the results of these observational studies that we hear so much about, they can be glommed on to by journalists and others who want to draw attention to an issue or who are looking for a good story. And often what gets reported goes way beyond what the data actually shows. So this is one reason for the kind of confusion surrounding reports of epidemiologic findings.
There's another dictum that the dose determines the danger, so to speak. Can you comment on the significance of this dictum?
Well, back in the 16th century, the physician and astrologer Paracelsus stated that all things are poisonous and only the dose makes the poison. Now, this principle is one of the cornerstones of toxicology to this day, and we too often forget this crucial point. We see many instances of heightened alarm about trace contaminants in food, water, and the environment, but less attention is given to the fact that with modern instrumentation, we can measure the presence of a contaminant down to parts per billion or even parts per trillion. But just because we can measure something doesn't mean that it is at a level where it's going to affect our physiology. If we were affected by every trace of residue that we come in contact with, we would all be dead. We've seen scares about the presence of chemicals such as acrylamide and glyphosate in food, for example, in children's cereals, where understandably gets a lot of attention. But these stories almost never mention the fact that one would have to consume one's body weight in cereal in a single day to really take in enough of the chemical to pose any risk.
I want to raise another issue related to this. Clearly, we need to be concerned with potential toxicity. And so we want to have an aggressive system, and we also, I think, want to monitor the companies and the industries that are making these products to make sure that the consumer is adequately protected. There is an issue some people have raised called regulatory capture. I wonder if you can explain that concept and inform us about how that plays into this issue of evaluating toxic chemicals.
Regulatory capture is a term that's been developed by lawyers who deal in administrative law. It means that those who are regulated become the dominant and undue influence over that regulatory agency, and they, in effect, capture that agency. Now, I want to add that regulatory capture can also mean a dominant and undue influence by others aside from simply the industry that's regulated, from pressure groups such as outside environmental organizations or competitors of the regulated industry. Now, again, in our society, because we value the right to petition government and we value the right to freely associate with others like-minded to us to influence the government, regulatory agencies must and should be open to comments and points of views from the regulated industry, from opposing pressure groups, from competing industries. That's all well and good. But simultaneously, that regulatory agency must be careful to avoid dominant and undue influence from any particular group in society, so that the agency is enforcing that law in a way that's really meant to be not unduly or dominantly influenced by one particular group.
How serious a problem is that?
The articles and from political science and law have shown it to be a very legitimate concern. As to how serious it is, I often think is in the eye of the beholder. In other words, you really have to ask whose ox is being gored, whose political power has the upper hand, whose viewpoint seems to be reflected in the philosophy or the language and the actions of the regulatory agency.
We have a number of ways to hold industry accountable and also to ensure the public safety on introduction and use of various chemicals. One, of course, is regulation, and the other is the legal system. We have a current case ongoing involving the weed killer glyphosate, originally patented by Monsanto, which has recently been taken over by Bayer, and some enormous judgments in the hundreds of millions of dollars that glyphosate was harmful to the point of being carcinogenic. What do you make of this? Is that a judgment on the carcinogenic and actual dangers of this chemical, or something else going on here?
Well, it's my impression that the scientific consensus is that Roundup, compared to other alternative weed control chemicals, is safe and preferable. Remember that farmers must control weeds in order to have productive fields, and weeds are competitors for sunlight, moisture, nutrients, with the planted crop. Farmers have always used methods to control weeds, and Roundup was a modern, or is a modern, chemical method of weed control. At the same time, as I remarked earlier, there has been a trend antagonistic to science in agriculture. One of those manifestations is antagonism to the use of chemicals. In light of the regulations over the use of chemicals in agriculture, and in light of the scientific consensus about Roundup, I have the opinion that Roundup is safe for health, it's better for the environment than alternatives, and it's needed to control weeds so that we can produce the food, fibers, and fuels that society expects from farmers and ranchers.
Dr. Kabat, could you address the science related to glyphosate and its potential hazards and risks?
Roundup is the world's most widely used herbicide weed killer, and it's been in use for over 40 years. And scientists regard it as, relatively speaking, environmentally benign and having low toxicity compared to other products, such as atrazine, for example, and copper sulfate. And it actually has a toxicity which is less than that of table salt and less than that of aspirin. Furthermore, it's highly valued by farmers who fear that mounting a campaign to ban it, as we see going on, particularly in Europe but elsewhere as well, is going to reduce crop yields and increase the costs of produce. If you only focus on your dislike of chemicals and don't realize that there need to be distinctions and that our survival depends on chemicals, then you really lose sight of the fact that many things that we do, we accept the toxicity or the danger. We accept it in driving automobiles. We accept it for those of us who drink a glass of wine. And so part of romanticism is being sort of absolutist and that any amount of a chemical is to be worried about.
Well, let me interject something here. Let's assume that glyphosate was banned around the world. What would be the effects of these other chemicals that would have to replace it on the environment and on other people?
It has to be replaced by something. And the things that are available to replace it have a much worse profile.
Let me just add there that in the 1990s, researchers at Cornell University developed what they called an environmental impact quotient to evaluate various pesticides and herbicides glyphosate as a herbicide, using that Cornell environmental impact quotient, the EIQ, glyphosate has a lower EIQ than the herbicides it replaced, such as atrazine or copper sulfate, and has a low EIQ in ranking overall, if you just sort of list them. And from several studies that I've read, the widespread use of glyphosate in conjunction with glyphosate-tolerant crops has reduced the EIQ of agriculture, that is the environmental impact quotient of agriculture, by about 15%. And I consider that a significant reduction.
I would like to underscore an important point here that both of you have raised, which is that chemicals are a necessary part of agriculture. Organic farmers use them. Conventional farmers use them. We don't just sprinkle fairy dust and get rid of weeds. The key thing is to do cost-benefit analysis, risk-risk analysis, and see what would happen if glyphosate was banned. Nature Communications actually had a 2017 study that looked at 118 active herbicides and compared their toxicity levels. And despite the hue and cry about the dangers of glyphosate, it ranked in the lowest 10% of potential toxicity. In other words, it's basically one of the most benign and safe herbicides that exist out there. And the conclusions of the authors in that study, if I can quote from it, is that if glyphosate use was discontinued, the resulting displacement of glyphosate by other herbicides that would be substituted is likely to have a negative impact on chronic health risks faced by pesticide applicators. So we have to keep things in perspective here. We want agriculture to flourish and bring its benefits. And I think we should be very careful about disposing of an herbicide that's been in use for many decades, used safely, and that every major oversight agency in the world that's looked at the risk issues involved with glyphosate has determined that it's not a carcinogen or a serious threat to human health.
John, let me present this to you. Last year, there was a study that was published in the Journal of the National Academy of Sciences that said that glyphosate was killing bees.
I mean, this is an example of the kind of proliferation of problematic science that we're seeing. That study looked at the impact of glyphosate on bees. There's absolutely no evidence other than this suggested study that there could be an impact. And when you look at the study, it really falls apart that the dose causes danger. Bees are not injected or drink glyphosate. They encounter it in the environment through foraging, and that's not how the bees were essentially dosed in this study. And the central finding of the study is that the bees perform worse when they were exposed to the lowest amount of glyphosate. So serious scientists do not take this study as indicative of any potential new revelations about the harm of glyphosate.
The scare over a potential link between Roundup and cancer appears to have begun with a now widely criticized statement put out by the World Health Organization agency known as the International Agency for Research on Cancer, the IARC, and this study was in 2015. In that year, IARC put glyphosate in a cancerous category one level below widely recognized harmful activities like smoking. Could you explain what the WHO cancerous categories are and what level of risk they gave to glyphosate?
They have five groups. And the first group is known human carcinogens such as tobacco smoking, asbestos, radon, and so on. And few people would quarrel with group one. The second group are judged by the agency to be probably carcinogenic. And glyphosate is in that group. So is working at night or having a rotating shift, working as a hairdresser, a long list of other exposures. Below that is possibly carcinogenic. In group three, there's not enough evidence available to make a determination. And what this tells me is that IARC has a very, very different classification system from all other health and regulatory agencies. And the difference comes down to the fact that even though it talks about risk, what it's really evaluating is not risk. What IARC focuses on is the potential for the agent in question to cause cancer. Well, a statistician looked at IARC's judgment about cell phones, which they announced in 2011, I believe, to be possibly carcinogenic. And this statistician from MD Anderson said, well, what does that mean? Anything is a possible carcinogen. So I would add one other thing about IARC. They were in the business of providing these assessments for cancer researchers. So I would argue that many of these things that we're hearing about, glyphosate, red meat, DDT in the past, and cell phones, have absolutely no relevance. All they do is scare ordinary people, and there's no reason to single them out.
Let me add a bit of additional context to what Jeffrey has just commented on about the procedures of IARC. It seems that with this classification of glyphosate in group 2A, it turned out, or it seems to be, that there were really some irregularities. Several people heavily involved in the IARC report are also involved in this Roundup litigation against Bayer. And email exchanges between these persons working in IARC and the attorneys who are bringing the litigation indicate that the decision was much influenced by, quote, the need, end quote, for a, quote, negative, end quote, classification by IARC. In other words, there seemed to have been a kind of working together to get a negative classification to bolster the bringing of these lawsuits. And this information raises significant issues about conflicts of interest within IARC and particular conflicts of interest about this particular glyphosate classification. To come back to something you asked earlier, it could be that the antagonists to Roundup have gained regulatory capture over IARC. That is, for their special interest, they are exercising dominant and undue influence.
Very often, we see chemicals that get attention. We see an early study going back to the 70s or the 80s, and they found something, say, with cancer. And what happens is that other researchers look into databases or do a new study collecting new information, and they try to do a larger, more powerful study. Very often what happens, any risk goes away. And there's a classic example of this with the huge scare about DDT causing breast cancer and other cancers in the 80s and 90s. And over time, as larger studies were done, any risk associated with using DDT snapped back from a fourfold increase in breast cancer to 1.5 to 1.0, to no risk at all. And someone referred to this as the Proteus effect. And this applies to glyphosate. Very limited occupational studies found an initial association with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, a rare type of lymph cancer. So this was the starting point, and this is what IARC picked up on. And just to summarize some of the most glaring scientific problems with the IARC report, in 2015, they judged that the human evidence was not adequate, even with the early crude studies, to judge whether glyphosate was a carcinogen. So they focused on the animal studies. And what they did was a real travesty, because basically they selected studies that seemed to show an association in either rats or in mice. But what they did was very strange. If male rats showed an effect, they emphasized that, but played down the fact that the effect wasn't seen in female rats. And actually, there were inverse associations, which means that it looked as if glyphosate actually decreased the cancer risk in some animals, but they didn't pay any attention to those findings. So they really cherry-picked the data on animals, and that was what they relied on for their conclusion. The second point is that they knew that a very powerful, large agricultural health study run by the National Cancer Institute was in the works. One of the senior researchers leading that study, Aaron Blair of the National Cancer Institute, he chaired the committee that issued the glyphosate report. And furthermore, people knew that they had analyzed the data on all sorts of herbicides and had published them, but for some strange reason, they didn't publish the results on glyphosate. And some people suspect that they didn't publish the results on glyphosate because they were resoundingly negative. They totally exonerated glyphosate as a cause of cancer. That paper came out in 2018. But the astounding thing, in addition to the irregularities Gabe pointed to, is that they nowhere referred to the existence of these massive data on 54,000 farmers and pesticide applicators. They found absolutely no evidence of a cancer risk. And this is what I call a Cadillac study. This was a prospective study of these farmers who were followed for a period of 20 years. So these data really mean something. And judges say, no, EPA is not relevant. Only the IARC report is relevant.
You both make a pretty powerful case that the scientific evidence is strong that glyphosate is not only not a carcinogen, it's not particularly toxic relative to other herbicides, but I would push back and say, you know, a jury looked at this, and they're supposed to be impartial, and multiple juries have now looked at this, and they've all concluded that the evidence suggests that it is. What's the disconnect here between the jury, which seems to believe that IARC had it right, and you and many other scientists, including three divisions of the World Health Organization, which says that glyphosate is benign in comparison to other toxic herbicides?
Okay. Well, there are very few countries where these kinds of issues are decided by a jury. And the science is so unbelievably complex, and if the public is so divided about these matters, will get their information from different sources, how is a jury supposed to determine what the science says? In a jury trial of a similar issue, it's absolutely human nature for people to see the individual who has this serious cancer and to want to have an explanation for why they developed that cancer. Now, we know very, very little about the causes of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but there's an emotional response, and we feel that the corporation, by definition, must be greedy and having total disregard of human welfare after profit, and the chemical must have caused it. So it's not a good mechanism, I think, for getting at the truth. Furthermore, what creeps into the picture is that positive studies, even if they're crummy studies, get more traction and get more attention than studies like the agricultural health study that don't find a risk. There are over 13,000 cases pending against Bayer for glyphosate. I think what should happen in a rational society is that there should be a hearing on the science before a judge. And in that case, the judge would see why the EPA and the Food and Agricultural Organization and the Australians and French and so on have determined that glyphosate is not carcinogenic. And they'd explain what's going on with IARC, and then a rational decision could be reached. I don't know how likely that is.
Well, let's cut right to the chase and speak to exactly what this case is based on. And I'm going to quote here from an article in the Rolling Stone magazine. Internal documents produced in court indicated Monsanto had reason to believe glyphosate was dangerous as early as 1983, when a study conducted by the company discovered a statistically significant increased risk of cancer in mice who were treated with glyphosate. The EPA was alarmed by the finding, But Monsanto dismissed the results, saying it wasn't definitive because a single mouse who was not exposed to the pesticide also developed a tumor. The agency wanted the study replicated, but Monsanto refused. They fought over that mouse's kidney for years, spending millions of dollars on experts instead of just doing the test. The EPA even offered a compromise. Let's just do a kidney and liver test. Monsanto said no. It's amazing how often they're able to say no to the EPA. The reason the company was able to say no to the agency, ostensibly charged with regulating its products, says Nathan Danley, a senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, is because the pesticide companies literally bankrolled the EPA's pesticide office. Under the Pesticide Registration Improvement Act, pesticide manufacturers are required to pay registration fees, and those fees amount to about a third of the office's operating budget. The system was originally conceived as a way to make sure the companies who profit from the product pay for the costs associated with regulating those products rather than the taxpayers. But in Donnelly's view, the plan has backfired spectacularly. He said, quote, "If industry is paying for 30 to 40% of the operating costs, the salaries of the pesticide office, who are they working for?" And I'd like to ask you all, what's your opinion on this whole thesis of the case against Monsanto?
There's a number of moving parts to this story. The conspiracy theory that because the government requires companies to pay fees in any way would compromise the government is just absurd. It's a hands-off relationship. We pay fees all the time for all kinds of services, and it doesn't mean those agencies are captured. But let's get to the actual charge itself, that somehow there was this bombshell study that showed that glyphosate causes cancer. There's a number of things wrong with that premise. First of all, we're now entering what's called single study syndrome, where you can isolate one study and try to generalize from that. The reason we regulate based on the sum of all the evidence is because we know that there's a lot of noise in every study, and you don't take one study, but you take dozens of studies. In the case of glyphosate, we have over 800 studies that have looked at this issue. But if you even want to look into this particular study, it was a really lousy study. And actually, the statistics of the mouse study were reviewed a number of years later by a scientist who had worked at the National Cancer Institute, Robert Taroni, a statistician. And this study did not show what the plaintiff attorney's consultant is now claiming. In fact, the findings were very contradictory, and in no way is this considered a smoking gun. Unfortunately, a trial jury is not able to distinguish between smoke and fire, and in this case, they may have been snookered by the kind of hysteria generating by a consultant such as this, whose views are obviously biased and contradict the basic science of 800 or so studies on glyphosate that show, according to every major regulatory agency in the world, that the herbicide is safe.
I haven't read the transcripts of the trials. I haven't looked at the specific evidence. But from what I have read, the lawyers for the plaintiffs in these cases have not really focused on the science. They have emphasized, yes, the questionable IART classification, but they have not been interested in really going into the kind of analysis and the risk and all the other agency findings that we've been discussing. Rather, they've really emphasized a kind of an anti-corporate, anti-business, anti-modern agriculture, anti-chemical viewpoint, and on top of that, they've added a kind of a conspiratorial layer of how regulatory agencies have evaluated and regulated Roundup. In other words, they've cast a kind of conspiratorial view that the Environmental Protection Agency, which I'm referring to because this is in the United States, has somehow not performed its function. This is back to this idea about regulatory capture. And so they've really emphasized themes that really are not focused on the science. The IARC is a kind of a way into the lawsuit. Now, I'm a lawyer, and this doesn't really surprise me because lawyers are really almost always trying to tell the jury a story of good versus evil, David versus Goliath, an individual person with a diagnosed threatening disease versus the marketer or the creator of that product, who's generally a corporation. And so it turns out that you shouldn't really expect the trial in many ways to really be directly about the science, and I don't think these were. These are really trials that were more about morality plays, and that's what happens. And then how you would deal with that, that's a different issue.
Well, if I was Bayer, I mean, wouldn't it be possible for me to just say these jurors are not scientists, so this should be thrown out because it's not a jury of their peers?
Well, I don't think you're wrong in your sense or feelings. A lot of people have talked about we need to have sort of what I'll call expert judges or expert juries in certain areas. And, for example, we do that in the patent context. We have a special court to deal with patents, and yet at the same time we also do allow jurors to render judgments about patent issues. So there are specialized courts at times, but in our system, we really don't have a specialized court in which we say these issues go to a jury of scientists. And so, though your sense is that what's on trial here is very much a scientific issue, and in a sense that's correct, that means we have a disconnect between the way sort of our system works and these very complex issues in certain cases that relate to causation, risk analysis, and the scientific issues that arise in a case like glyphosate. Judges do have the power, and maybe they need to be more assertive in these complex scientific cases, to control the evidence that's allowed to be presented or the evidence that's excluded on these complex subjects. And in these particular glyphosate trials, Bayer has already appealed these jury judgments and damage awards. And one of the major points they're making on the appeal is, in fact, the impact of various judicial rulings on what was allowed to be introduced as evidence and what was excluded. Bayer has particularly put the emphasis on the evidence that was excluded because, as I understand it, the judges were very narrow in allowing evidence to be presented about the findings of the regulatory agencies, including EPA and others around the world, including the National Cancer Institute big epidemiological study to which Jeffrey referred earlier. The judges were very limiting in allowing evidence from these agencies that affirmed the safety of glyphosate and determined that glyphosate, when properly used, is not a causative chemical for the cancers alleged in these trials. Also, I'd like to just reemphasize that the jury is really very much enshrined in our legal system. In fact, there's a constitutional right to a jury. But I have to also say that I think in a case like this of glyphosate that heavily involves these science issues, that's a very tough and hard thing for jurors to understand and to reach a resolution that reflects the consensus of science. As a society, we are not really very well educated about science, and we are prone to being misled about science and about risk and causation and risk analysis. So in some ways, you can simply say what happened in these jury trials is it is, in fact, societal deficiencies and understanding that are now sort of writ large in this subsection of society called the jury. And I want to just add one final thing. Jurors do make mistakes, and legal systems can get off track in their understanding of issues. That's just kind of my general sense of what's happened here in these three trials.
What implications would this ruling have on the agricultural industry moving forward?
If these legal rulings were to result in the withdrawal or a substantial restriction on the use of glyphosate, generally known as Roundup, what it would mean for farmers as a practical matter is that they would lose a weed control system that has been very effective and very environmentally friendly, and that includes herbicide-tolerant crops to glyphosate and the use of what's called reduced or no-tillage agriculture, because spraying glyphosate to destroy the weeds is much preferable than to tillage for all sorts of reasons, including to avoid runoff of soil into our lakes and rivers. So farmers would really lose access to this modern system of agriculture. Now, in the United States, that would be a tremendous impact, because about 90% of four major crops, cotton, canola, soybeans, and corn or maize, are glyphosate-tolerant crops. In Europe, where they hardly use these, the impact would be less, but even there, farmers are complaining very much about the bans on the use of glyphosate that are being proposed. In a worst-case scenario, if these legal rulings forced American agriculture to abandon this herbicide-tolerant crops, and I think going back before to the 1970s is not a wise move.
Do you have any parting thoughts?
Here are some of the final thoughts I have. I think it's really important that the regulatory system reflect solid science, and that they really reflect in their regulations the technical knowledge of the science so that it's properly framed in the drafted regulations. I think that's really important, that our regulatory agencies get the science and the technology correct in the drafted regulations. And I say that for several reasons, because if they don't get it correct, if they seem to reflect too much fear in the regulations, they're miseducating the public, and they're creating apprehensions in the public that are not appropriate. Moreover, as we've made several references to during this discussion, if the government or if the regulatory agencies don't get the science and technology correct in their regulations, if they over-regulate and create fears, this then opens the door for special interest groups that really have an agenda to promote miseducation and to promote fear among the people. Then the agency has just opened the door for that to be magnified. So I guess one of my parting thoughts is simply to say we really need to be careful to reflect good science and the technical details in our regulations so that we don't miseducate our public and open the door to groups that have an agenda to be anti-science and to mislead the public with fear.
Reflecting on some of what Drew said about juries is that we really have a woefully undereducated population regarding things like statistics and probability and the basics of science. And that's what leaves people prey to thinking that a part per trillion of some relatively benign compound is something to worry about. This is a tall order, but I think that school curricula should incorporate things like probability and scientific reasoning, and it should be carried through throughout the school years, the way arithmetic does, leading up to algebra and so on, to give kids some sort of basic literacy in science and how to think about things. I do think that it should be something that we aspire to. And in a way, I think the French are initiating curricula to help high school kids determine what is fake news and what is reliable news. My other thought is that when we have a bandwagon, whether it's regarding endocrine-disrupting chemicals, as we've seen a couple of years back, or glyphosate or GMOs, they become self-perpetuating dramas in which people choose a side. But these are often very narrow discussions, and they divert attention away from other questions that are terribly, terribly important, like the emergence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, or like mutation of Asian flu to possibly become a pandemic. And there, too, we need to educate people. And finally, what strikes me is that there's very little appreciation for the truly mind-boggling advances in science. And somehow these advances get absolutely no attention compared to these fleeting scares that people get so concerned about. If we had some appreciation for how much progress has been made that would help to put some of these things in perspective and help us to focus on more important questions.
Well, I want to thank you, gentlemen, for being on our show. It was a really wonderful discussion.
Thank you very much.
And now for our final thoughts. Isaac Asimov was once quoted as saying that anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge.
That quote defines the very conundrum that exists between the authority that is embedded in expertise and the inadequacy of the lay public to be able to accurately scrutinize the failures of science, even as we benefit from its successes.
The only way to truly bridge that divide when science falls under public scrutiny is with far more scientists on our juries, in our legislatures, and in the halls of Congress. And that's it for our show today. This is Gabe Ignetti.
And this is John Entine.
We will be signing off till next time.